Hello.
Hello.
Mrs. Marlowe, yes?
Harper, yes.
Wonderful. Geoffrey.
Hi.
Do, come in.
Thank you.
Hello. Welcome to the Extra Credits Plus of people we never get to discuss on the podcast. Men.
Yeah, so few movies are about them, you know?
We never hear about the patriarchy in films. I'm Trey.
And I'm Kelsey.
So it's been a busy week. Our jobs have been crazy, and I was working to get Alex Garland on the show. So a lot was happening behind the scenes this past few days. I'm not sure the timing will work to have him on, but we did get a screening through his team for Civil War, which is really exciting. And I also just got more screeners for an upcoming show for HBO that hopefully we can talk about sometime soon and maybe speak to the creatives on there too. I'm not going to announce that right now, but I'm really excited about that as well. But we're back with our series on Alex Garland with 2022's Men,
yes,
which I think is one of the most hotly debated and divisive movies of the 2020s somehow.
Yeah.
Much like Civil War is sure to be in the next coming weeks. I'm sure people will react to that movie in a very normal way. Do you kind of find it surprising that Garland is now viewed as this divisive figure? Because in doing prep and revisiting his written, produced, and directed films, this guy doesn't really come off as like a scathing provocateur who makes like B-plus genre movies that is just trying to push people and be a contrarian. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it feels like people just, or I feel like maybe just recently, he's been re-examined as a mainstream kind of contrarian filmmaker. But I don't see him that way.
Well, I think some of it has to do with what we were talking about on our Ex Machina pod that we did earlier this month, which is the kind of fight clubification that you brought up, right?
Yeah.
About a like subsect of his audience really enjoying his films that he is actually very overtly and directly critiquing,
right? Yeah.
Which is fascinating. Like, you know, we talked about a lot on Ex Machina how he in interviews has been very explicit about critiquing the Oscar Isaac and Domhnall Gleeson characters,
right,
and he actually kind of like views them as a little pathetic and really ego driven. And, you know, you hear people who are responding to Alex Garland's movies talk about the specific Ex Machina theme of Ava, the android AI, manipulating Domhnall Gleeson's character. And obviously, you know, that's like coded, even though she is a robot, like that's coded as like, oh, isn't this movie fascinating about a woman manipulating a man? And that's not the movie that he set out to make. He's very explicit about that in his interviews. And I do think he's pretty on the nose in, you know, Ex Machina and specifically Men.
Right.
But yeah, so it's fascinating that he's looked at as contrarian. You know, Civil War, we have not seen yet. We saw a sneak preview, a 5-minute preview, but that could be maybe a deserved time. I know a lot of people have had a huge reaction to that. It's been very divisive. So I am curious to see what we will think about with that movie. But so far, I think he's been very on the nose critiquing masculinity and constructs. So it is weird to think that he is seen as this contrarian director.
Yeah, what's also interesting about that is directors who are seeking to provoke, you know, arguments that are unhealthy are usually doing that with the hopes of commercial success. And his movies aren't exactly super financially successful. You know, he's still, even though, you know, I use the word mainstream, he's still working with A24 a lot. And these are indie projects for the most part, and they're mid low budgets. But Civil War is like a $75 million movie. I mean, A24 and DNA Films are obviously trusting him quite a bit, which is a surprise because he makes like these movies that aren't necessarily conventionally entertaining or even exciting. Like he makes atmospherically bleak, surreal movies that can sometimes have moments of thrills, especially in the last act. And they can even be funny looking at you, Oscar Isaac, dancing on the dance floor.
Yeah. But I'm going to tear up this dance floor.
But his work is mostly pretty gloomy, you know, with like this intellectual and emotional exercise running through it that's pretty conversational with the audience.
Yeah, I think that his films like can be distancing in the atmosphere that they've set. You know, he views himself as a writer first. But I mean, I think that's an interesting question to start with, this idea of like, how do audiences view him? Because he just announced his retirement. And, you know, I think has said that before.
Yeah, I think he said that for Men.
Yeah.
Too. Yeah.
And I do think that's something that people in the film industry will say, like, I'm taking a break from this. You know, retirement is a very like specific word of saying I'm not coming back to directing, even though he will still continue to write.
Yeah.
Following the 28 days later.
Hell yeah, script. Baby. 28 yeah. years later trilogy. Danny Boyle, Garland coming back, Cillian Murphy.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
sick.
And I feel like more people will even check it out after Oppenheimer, obviously, with Cillian. But
did you hear the news this morning about Jodie Comer also going to co-star with Cillian Murphy?
Yes, that's awesome.
Isn't that wild?
We love Jodie Comer.
I know. I hope they bring back Naomi Harris too. It'd be so sick.
Yeah. But I think like the reason that he cited for retiring was the idea of people misreading his films. Like, and he felt like he doesn't have control over the narrative, even though it is really interesting because I would argue that we're going to talk about a lot of filmmakers probably, right, that he is kind of in a cohort of.
Sure, yeah.
Like Eggers and Astor and
Jordan Peele.
Yeah. But he is like very on the nose with his critiques and his...
Or at least the major themes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I feel like it's less critique and more interesting question that isn't necessarily open-ended, but it certainly is conversational.
Yeah.
That's a goal.
I think the questions are inherently kind of... critiquing.
Right, but he doesn't want to be preachy. It's not
constructs.
Like a lecture.
Yeah. Yes, that is actually true. But I do think that people who call his movies pretentious
especially
because
men.
They're
I've seen that, yeah.
they're straightforward in their questions.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's also because of dealing with topics or through lines in his films that are so contemporary and zeitgeisty, like AI, ecological disasters, or patriarchy and toxic masculinity. These are topics that are on everyone's minds over the past 10-15 years. So you know, I want to go back to something you just brought up. I think he is in this special tier of that culturally relevant cohort of Jordan Peele at the top, Robert Eggers, Ari Aster, arguably a few others, but this is a group of filmmakers who have been raising the stakes and scope in their stories in each new project. And specifically Peele and Garland, and I would say, I guess, Aster too, play in the contemporary world in really bizarre ways, which many filmmakers sway away from. So they open the door for just different interpretations across the board because people feel very kind of, they're projecting a lot of what's, you know, on their mind and their lives onto the screen. And that comes with, you know, making movies in this era. You know, if you want to make a movie set now, you kind of have to deal with the consequences. And this is one of them, especially for someone as self-serious as Alex Garland.
Yes. You know, maybe that is why, like when you're talking about those filmmakers, that's why Alex Garland is specifically critiqued, because it feels like his movies do feel serious in a way, even though they are so absurd. Where if you look at like an Aster movie, you know, obviously like there's such absurdity. There's comedy in a lot of ways.
Even
in
Midsommar,
they're playing in that genre. And then so they get to have like an escapist element to them. And then with Eggers, you know, you have kind of like still talking about men and a lot of themes and questions that Garland does, but wrapped up in an absurdist, like comedic lighthouse version, watching Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson just
incredible,
like mumble around an island for a couple hours. And or like an action, right? More like the Northmen, wrapped up in that. And so people don't have to be spending an hour in the theater being directly kind of challenged and having to interrogate and sit with really, right, what Alex Garland does in his pacing.
Right.
And then Peele, you know, is looking at more of the horror genre in like a comedic, from his background, right? Like way. And he is like kind of stand-up comedy or sketches do, are exposing contradictions in social life. So I think that Garland is probably like responded to in a way, if people are like, oh, like I'm going to take this seriously because it feels like it is being delivered in a serious way because of the pacing, because of what we talked about. He's a writer first. Mm-hmm. And so he really wants to establish atmosphere. And it does have that effect, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think also one of the reasons that we're comparing these filmmakers is because they're all playing in a similar subgenre of horror, right? They're all playing in like this surreal science fiction absurdist place. And I think the master of that right now is probably Bong Joon-ho. If you're going to talk about the masters of provocation, I think Bong Joon-ho is right there with someone like David Fincher. So like those are the kind of filmmakers that are the most mainstream in this space. Mm-hmm. But it's really nice to see all these, you know, these four that we're talking about do so well right now and get funded by indie studios in some cases, and really be able to create their original worlds. But yeah, I agree with everything you just said. I think that is why Garland is the most divisive, because he's so very, very self-serious. He thinks that there's a lot of stakes when you make movies about contemporary issues. I think we agree with that. Like, you know, ethically, I think what he stands for with his movies is something that, you know, maybe not, I'm not always politically on the same wavelength, but ethically, I understand why he's bringing that kind of, you know, seriousness to the work. Whereas someone like Aster, like you're saying, is like cynically funny, very dark humor. Peele has that accessible comedy style. It's very formulaic, but new because he's this master storyteller giving stories to characters and actors who have not had the opportunity in Hollywood to have these kind of original stories between horror and comedy. And then you have someone like Eggers, who's like surreally violent, like the most violent in the most surreal ways, and something like The Lighthouse to a bizarre place where you are, you know, laughing at almost this hallucinogenic humor of, you know, or even The Northman, of like 265, 250 pound naked dudes fighting over their honor.
On a volcano.
On a live volcano. I mean, that's hilarious. And, you know, Willem Dafoe and Robert Pattinson getting drunkenly sexually frustrated with each other is also really great. And so he also brings another kind of bizarreness to his work. But Garland doesn't really have any of that in his movies. One of the reasons I think a lot of people like the Oscar Isaac scene, because it's so iconic and it's Isaac and he's dancing and it's funny, is also because it doesn't tonally fit in the movie. So it's so jarring when it happens. Mm-hmm. And you're like, oh, where's this Alex Garland director? Where's this writer? Where did he get this scene? Why is it not in his other movies? And I just think that he, you know, he feels that he's dealing with very serious work. You know, it feels like he's more closer to a Darren Aronofsky, you know, in that mother lane.
That's a good comparison. It does, yeah. And I think a lot of his films do feel surreal and kind of like, I do think people feel like his movies are sometimes taxing to watch, like general audiences.
Yeah, you've noted that for sure on rewatching all of his work.
Yeah,
over the past
and
few weeks.
I don't know if that's kind of like a harsh, I guess, word, but I do think, like I said, they're distancing in a way. And I do think that does have to do with like the responsibility he feels, but because there's no levity, I think that is also why people are, you know, really drawn to having a conversation with his movies.
Yes. And I think that can be distancing, you know, as you've put it a couple times, especially with a movie like Annihilation, which I think I really admire. I think is really ambitious. But that's a movie that you've talked about being distanced from emotionally.
Yeah. Well, I think that movie in particular is one that I am not on board with the characters, because I feel like they are characters in a novel or something. I don't actually feel like they're real people. And that has to do a lot with the hyper fantasy bubble world that we're put in, the high contrast of being in that kind of garden
dreamlike
space. So that has a lot to do with the movie in general too. But that's the one that I'm like the least in on. And but I do really love the ending of that movie.
Sure. I think the last 30 minutes of all of his movies are so memorable. And I think the pace can be a struggle for some. It can feel a little bit like a job trying to get through the first 30 minutes of his movies. I don't feel that way, but I understand the critiques of people. Like I totally sympathize with those things.
I only feel that on Annihilation.
I think one of the reasons why Annihilation feels like that is because it's based off a novel and Alex Garland is already a writer. So he's bringing his very dense, like feel bad allegory vibe to something that's already very, very textually dense. And so that's why that movie definitely feels like that. Maybe for those who aren't familiar with Alex Garland, you didn't really know that he is mainly a writer. And he's actually written many horror films. Men might seem like the first horror film to a lot of people who have just come into becoming an Alex Garland fan. But he wrote 28 Days Later for Danny Boyle, for horror fans like myself, is like one of the best horror films ever made. And I think probably a top two, top three zombie movie too, with those George Romero ones from the 60s, 70s and on. I think it's a masterpiece in dystopian films too. So I'm really excited to see if anything similar there with Civil War. Then he made Sunshine, which we both just checked out for the first time about a week ago now, which
you had me in the first half. That's what I'll say.
I liked all of it. I was into all of it. I think a drama workplace ethical dilemma is really cool. Alien's my favorite movie of all time, and the first half
there
is excellent.
There were Prometheus elements, like asking the the questions. It didn't feel like the normal trolley. You know, like annoying question that we often see in like superhero movies, but it was actually like interested in like sacrificing, like thinking about like what is worth saving for the greater good.
Right. Yeah.
But
you do have like a slasher being like godlike at the end of that movie, not to spoil anything.
Let's just say though, I said this on Ex Machina, but I think it is fascinating that he is like so obsessed with skin. Like and he has so many really tough to watch scenes for me specifically.
I guess people get cut open every one of his movies.
Yeah, we have like Dom Hall's arm.
Annihilation, Oscar Isaac cuts that guy's stomach open.
Oh, I forgot. Okay, I forgot about that because I was going to say Annihilation may be the only one that he doesn't. But then obviously, men will talk about today some scenes that like forehead. I like
the male door with the hand.
Yeah, I can't watch.
Yeah, I think Men, I mean, this is his first directed horror film, like traditionally a horror film. And Men is a lot different than 28 Days Later and Sunshine. Men is much more self-aware. And it feels almost sometimes like a meta transparent movie and playing in this like surreal folk nightmare horror genre. And I would argue on rewatch, even though Men is like certainly tragic in moments, it has moments of levity of what you were talking about. There are darkly humorous moments, especially in revisiting it, because we'd only seen it once or twice before prepping the past week or two for this now. And I think I've seen it like 5 times. And this most recent time I found myself, you know, just kind of laughing with Alex Garland at conventions or cliches that he's playing with.
Yeah. I mean, definitely the first time we saw it, I read it as a horror movie that it is again, like playing in the genre of, but I think especially, you know, after I think you said for like the third watch, you really start to understand the different characters that Alex Garland is kind of like poking fun at.
Yes.
And it feels like, again, like this idea of looking at the absurdity of a construct, but and these different versions of you know, the man, the men.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of really funny, especially from the Jeffrey character.
It's Jeffrey.
Right?
Yeah. It's got to be Jeffrey. The whole like, gee, come on, Jeffrey, fire up the engines.
Fire
like
up
that.
The engines.
All of that.
Pomegranate.
Roy Kinnear is excellent
there
in
we
this
go.
Movie. I actually, in rewatching, I was like, where was this guy's Oscar nomination? Everybody could have been.
He is really great.
It's fine to be divisive over this movie, but he does not feel like a caricature. I love James McAvoy and Split's pretty good in moments, but he makes James McAvoy's acting, you know, his performance in that movie feel more like a bit. Like that's how good Roy Kinnear is in that. It's pretty wild.
Yeah.
I guess in terms of people being distanced from Men to just kind of staying on like why people were kind of not in on this movie, I guess it also has this element of feeling Lynch-like in moments. There is something very like metaphysical, highly conceptual, highly philosophical to a pretentious degree. And even though that is purposeful, it's still very alienating. But that's the thing about Garland. His movies feel welcoming at first, alienating, and then welcoming again, and they kind of go through that weird journey, and you're just kind of disoriented by that type of experience. And he does create a disorienting reality because the world he creates in his stories aren't exactly like ours. They feel like hazier, distorted versions of our worlds. But I think because he makes movies that feel so close to our contemporary world, it elicits extreme reactions by the audience.
Yeah.
Because they don't really know how to feel about it because it's like tonally puzzling. And I think that tonal, it's not even imbalanced because it's intentional. It's just, it feels puzzling. I think that does a lot to people because they feel like they should be immersed into your movie, but instead they feel like provoked as a spectator and are forced to project their own feelings onto the screen and then watch the characters of his movies also feel like spectators of their own worlds. Like you watch Ava, it feels like she's a spectator of Oscar Isaac and Domhnall Gleeson's characters, you know, and very similar to Natalie Portman's character.
That's true.
Who feels like a spectator of whatever the hell is going on in that.
And especially with Jesse Buckley, right?
Like, and definitely Jesse Buckley's
you are right.
Harper.
He does make very like self-aware characters where and I think that like, we don't have a lot of movies like that. And it does create a barrier of that we're not used to seeing, I guess, right? Like this kind of suspense of disbelief and in other, you know, films. But I like that about his movies. I respect that about his movies. I do think that he does a really great job in establishing a very unique world. Yes. I do believe in the world building.
Yeah.
He said that his favorite scenes to shoot are ones without dialogue. And I think
you can feel that.
When we were watching that interview, you literally said, we know.
Yeah. But he's intentional in not being subtle. He's very intentional in his themes and symbols in a lot of his movies. And he's almost playing with the audience being in on the symbol, and especially in Men. But in those moments where you're just watching a landscape for like 15 seconds, he has so many of those like music video vignette like moments in Ex Machina. There's a ton of quiet moments in Annihilation, almost to like a brown noise, white noise kind of degree. And then in Men, for sure. But I think what Men, I'm a little bit more glued to the screen because of the genre. You know, especially the first time I watched it in theaters, which was an incredible experience because the sound mix in this film is insane. I'm in and out on the cinematography. I know a lot of people love the cinematography and color palette of Men, but the sound work in this movie is incredible, especially what they do with Jesse Buckley's voice in the tunnel throughout.
And Jesse Buckley's also, you know, amazing.
Really good in this.
I really can't believe that it's just the two of them.
Well, I guess there, I mean, there's Papa Asayidu. Yeah. I mean, there's really not many actors outside of like the woman cop. I think there's like four people in this movie and her friends, so five actors, but really just the two of them going head to head for the majority of the movie.
Yeah.
I want to ask you before we get into like the negative reaction to Men, before we start the movie and deep dive this, I think there are two or three lenses of Men of how to watch it and experience it when people revisit it.
Okay.
I know that sounds pretentious. I don't really care.
No,
we're deep diving this movie, so everybody get ready.
No, I also think it's important because of the ways that I've seen this movie talked about, even though I think it's like pretty straightforward. It's it was
in
really
ways,
interesting. Yeah, I guess in ways, because I do have different readings coming back to it that I've like realized, oh, this is what Alex Garland was trying to do. But people, when this movie came out, said, like, we already get this.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really interesting.
It was fascinating.
Yeah, because it's different than saying, like, I don't agree with what's going on in the movie, but we really don't have, we were joking at the very beginning of the pod, like, so few movies made about men, like, never get to talk about men and masculinity. But I do think that, you know, we don't have a lot of movies that are looking at constructs, and specifically, like, people have criticized Alex Garland for writing movies about women's experiences specifically, but I think that he actually isn't necessarily like writing from a woman's lens. I think you could actually argue that he's more interested in looking at the men in the movie, and again looking at the construct and their the absurdity, the contradictions, like with Oscar Isaac character and Domhnall Gleeson's character, and then obviously especially in Men, the different versions of men.
Yeah, I have some thoughts on the Harper character that I was reading negative reviews from critics, from Letterboxd essays, a lot of it having to do with how Harper is treated as a symbol more than a character. So I'll get to that in a second. But these are the two or three lenses or ways to watch Men, to me at least. You can watch them all together like I do, but I think people who really dislike this movie are watching it from one single lens, even if they're aware of all of them. So you have the British folk surrealist thriller aspect of this movie with like a crazy amount of historical subtext about institutional misogyny throughout history going through this English countryside with the two characters. And you also have this like interesting meta-textual commentary with this specific experience of watching this movie about the horror genre itself, which we can discuss in a second. And then you have the second lens on this movie, which is how most people seem to watch the film, which is like this self-important, self-serving home invasion slasher horror film with a very, very, very straightforward gender commentary that reflects our contemporary world to possibly, to some people, a dull degree. And I think the third way to kind of watch this movie, I guess, is just those two combined, you know, and just trying to experience this as an invasion movie, a slasher movie, a movie about gender dynamics, a movie about religion, not just constructs of gender, but also ideology, and looking at that through history, through multiple different eras. And I find the movie to be fascinating with all of that combined. But I could see if you were just watching this as, you know, Jesse Buckley's character as a symbol, running into this this character who's manifested from her grief or manifested from years of from thousands of years of patriarchy existing, and then just rolling your eyes at the movie, especially in the last 15 minutes with the slasher aspect. But did all that make sense? Because I think there are a lot of different lanes and avenues of how to attack this movie when talking about it and discussing it. And I can understand why picking just one or two of those, why this movie would feel incredibly pretentious and self-important.
Yeah, I think most people looked at it in the horror lens of the Rory Kinnear character is just a different version of like masculinity. Mm-hmm. And they're like, we get it. I do think that there's something interesting with even looking at Jesse Buckley's character. And I think that is fair what you're saying, like of kind of having your first walk away from this movie, or just like in general being like, this is pretentious and I'm kind of out.
Mm-hmm.
But there is something interesting that we'll talk about at the end, her reaction to the Rory Kinnear character, that I actually think is an interesting comment, and how Jesse Buckley was involved in the script and how she wanted to react at the very end and playing on that kind of slasher genre.
Right.
But I think that that is right. And it becomes far more interesting. And the reason I actually really do like this movie is because it talks, because of that combination that you were talking about, like the Green Man, the Sheila Nagig, the idea of constructs and how power is like naturalized in institutions.
Yes.
And there's also humor, there's levity with the Rory Kinnear character through Jeffrey specifically.
Mm-hmm.
And it also feels like a horror movie, which I enjoy.
It feels like an original horror film too. Like it feels like he created his own slasher.
Yeah.
Kind of easily with the Green Man without telling you much about his mythos, you know, and it's all kind of just implied or suggested.
Yes. And so I do think that it becomes far more interesting when you are looking at it. But I didn't know the history of Green Man and Sheila Nagig, like when I first watched it. I just thought, okay, this is like something to do with religion. And I think of course that has to do with like possibly the US audience and our context with the movie, because
we might not
understand those symbols as much.
Yeah.
So I can also understand people like not knowing that, because we had to do research to understand that coming from the US, and it makes the movie far more interesting and successful, I think. But you also have to know that, right?
Yeah, and I think audiences did not have patience for this movie's symbolism because of the pace. It's very meditative. Yeah. It's very atmospheric. He tries to build this ambiance and that doesn't always work. And these are also like really straightforward, intentionally so, historical provocations. When you see Harper biting an apple, a lot of people are just going to roll their eyes in the audience. Though I think Garland is trying to provoke the audience in question, okay, why do you know this about Harper biting the apple? And then trying to connect that to the Green Man, to the Sheila Nagig, to the vicar quoting Agamemnon and quoting the other poem about the Zeus assault of a Greek goddess, and then that becoming the king of Troy, and like all these different elements throughout history that make up the patriarchal institutions that we see today that make men feel like they're living in these like victim fantasies where they can victim blame women, or gendered violence or gender based violence happens. So I think all of it works if you have patience for it.
Right. If you're willing to look at the symbols and look into them.
Yeah.
Especially like from a US audience, because I think that people, any of our listeners, like who already had knowledge of the Green Man, like let us know if you already you had a different reading, I guess, going into it immediately.
Yeah, especially our British listeners about the Green Man, and then our Irish listeners about the Sheila Nagig, because I think those are where the two, let's call them...
like religious symbols,
icons,
right?
Yeah, like where they originated. But what's weird going off of that symbolism is that men wasn't interrogated in the same way that something like Ex Machina and Annihilation were. And instead, we had this immediate wave of reducing the movie to just being about how men are bad. And I saw a lot of funny tweets at the time, but like also, you know, highly reductive, that Alex Garland takes one gender course and made a horror movie. And I get it's a tedious movie to get through if you're not interested in this much subtext that's acting like it's subtext when really it's text. I get all of that. That can feel preachy and pretentious. And then I understand the tension around Harper's character and seeing a character being used as a symbol more than an actual realized person, especially during this time in the horror genre and thriller genre where so many horror movies are using that grief and trauma lens and then using a woman as a tool, as this like her experiences and this flashback framing device where you see her character is exploited in some way and then it's basically her grieving the entire movie. And I can understand why people are just kind of sick of that genre.
Yeah.
But this movie in particular, Men specifically, feels like it is hyper aware of that, those kind of like final girl cliches. And it seems like a movie that is in conversation with specific overly subtextual trauma porn horror genre movies that are exploiting conventions and final girl cliches. And it feels like a movie that's sort of poking at this prepackaged Reddit board explained, YouTube explained, discourse ready, symbol filled horror movie. It feels like it's trying to be a great version of that movie.
Here's everything you missed.
Exactly. Yes. And there are a lot of those essays on YouTube. I've watched them. They're pretty bad. They're very repetitive. And I think a lot of them are missing the point, and the interpretations of the movie are fascinating. Mm-hmm. This is a movie I regretted going deep on the Reddit boards on because of the interpretations of what Harper is going through. And then I did realize that Fight Club crowd from Ex Machina, they stayed. They're certainly read The Green Man in a way I did not even think of while watching this movie, which I'll get into when we deep dive it.
Okay, I'm so fascinated to hear.
So I can understand why people read Men as a symptom of this internet era storytelling issue in popular media, and also being a movie that's exploiting gender-based violence. Like, I understand that. But I just think it's more complex than that. Like I said, it feels like two or three films blended into one. Like, you know, you have the surreal thriller about gendered violence. You have the cycle of toxic masculinity. You have this allegorical symbol-filled folk horror. And then you also have, like I said, the Green Man, which is an original character. I feel like the Green Man is the A24 boogeyman, and nobody has talked about that. Like, he made a Freddy Krueger character.
He did, yeah. And it's so interesting that you say that, because I was just rewatching the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise for a class I'm a graduate TA for. It's like the sociology of horror. So looking at sociological concepts through horror films. And yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah.
But I in Nightmare Elm Street 2 specifically, where we have like the final boy character, there's a scene where Freddy Krueger is literally coming out of his stomach, like stretching his skin, right?
Yeah.
And also coming through his arm. And it looks so much like the Men imagery of our final scene of the kind of, again, like pregnant men, and especially the arm being sliced in two.
Well, yeah, that's like what I keep coming back to now on rewatching the movie. I'm just so impressed about how it's in conversation with horror conventions that it admires and ones that it's trying to question a little bit.
Yeah, there's a lot of like horror imagery, the final girl kind of tropes that we're seeing, especially towards the end, being toyed with. So
yeah,
it definitely is in conversation. I mean, people view this, I think, as a horror film, right?
I think so. I think a lot of people view it as a folk horror movie, like horror fans, you know, and we are horror fans, but we're not like, we don't have the horror encyclopedia mind that some horror fans do. But I kept thinking about The Wicker Man when watching this, which is impossible not to think about the original 1973 Wicker Man. And it obviously is, you know, a reference for Garland, who is a British filmmaker himself. And so that was something I thought about a lot. I thought about Persona and Suspiria and Possession and Tarkovsky and with Stalker, Solaris. And so like there are a lot of movies that I was thinking of tonally, but not necessarily structurally or exactly how this movie feels dreamlike and nightmarish like. I kept thinking of also recent films. And I try not to think of recent films when watching a newer movie because I just assume the director is not referencing a recent film. Mm-hmm. But there's one recent film in particular I really thought about a lot this past week, and that is Jordan Peele's Get Out, which I think to a lot of people is going to be a really odd comparison listening to this. Mm-hmm. But I think Jordan Peele and Alex Garland used the conventions of modern and contemporary horror in Get Out and in Men to explore something similar about identity, this kind of like perpetual exploitation of AI identity, right? In Get Out, the focus was obviously on race, and Men, it was obviously on gender, and both movies depict this like absurd level of micro and macro aggressions of racism in one movie and sexism in the other. And in Men, it's just very self-serious in its satire approach.
Yeah, I actually think those are great comparisons, because again, both movies are looking at constructs, and we talked about before how Peele looks at contradiction with humor, and Alex Garland, you're right, like I feel like this is more allegorical. And I think something that's interesting is with Alex Garland's movie, with Men specifically, I guess, because it does feel like his other movies kind of set up an audience to have a sort of mind bender ending, a surprise ending, something that feels a little bit like
it's Inception-esque.
Yes, exactly. And Men is just so straightforward, right?
Yeah.
I think allegory is the best way to put it. Like, it is just very clear about what it is trying to accomplish. And I don't mind that. Like,
yeah.
I think that like we have been a little bit, I think maybe people wanted something more.
YouTube explained Pilled, I think, is one thing. And then I think also,
but I don't think there's anything wrong with like a simple movie about the horrors of a specific construct.
Yes, I think he's playing with the simplicity of the genre too. Like, why are your expectations so low? And then also, why are your expectations in the horror genre rooted out of misogyny? Like, that's an interesting conversation for a filmmaker making a horror movie. He's not trying to make a bad movie. Like, he's trying to make a great horror film.
Oh no,
that's also trying to
bad. Yeah.
Provoke the audience about why they want what they want to see on screen. Like, why do they want to see Harper go down that dark tunnel? Why do they want to see Harper grab the hand of the Green Man as it comes through the mailbox, or see a knife go through his arm that visualizes the death of her husband? Like, why do they want to see those things is an interesting question. And then why do they not want to see certain things, like the birth scene, for example, which we'll get into, which is, again, like one of the absurdest, almost funny moments. Not almost, I do laugh at that scene now, like the rebirth scene, because of having that awareness of zooming out and feeling like this is more something in the Get Out lane, but just not as comedic in its approach.
Yeah.
But I was going to ask you something. I bring this up a lot the past few years, and then we can get into the movie. I know we're taking a long time at the top here, but we are a little late to the episode, so I don't mind doing that. In the post-Matrix world of cinema, there have been so many movies, and maybe post-Scream is a good way to put it too, but so many movies that are postmodern in a way where they are self-examining and self-critiquing while also trying to be a highly successful and original story. And I find that to be a very disorienting experience if you are not bringing humor to the movie, right? Like, Matrix is a good example of it being very successful because it's using action. It's not using humor. And so in a way that's kind of similar in terms of the way, I feel, at least when I'm watching a John Wick movie and a comedy, they kind of give me a similar feeling.
Yeah.
But like Gerwig's Barbie last year being very self-referential or self-critiquing with Mattel, and then also Margot Robbie playing Barbie, Jordan Peele's Nope, Chazelle's Babylon, Ari Aster's Beau Is Afraid, Wes, his Asteroid City movie, Fincher's The Killer is a really good example. The fourth Matrix film, to bring up another Matrix movie, or like more popular horror films that have done it, like Knock at the Cabin, right? These are all movies that are attempting to make as good a movie they can, but then are also attempting to self-interrogate their contradictions, their genres, their artifice, their storytelling devices, their commercial aspects. Like, why do you think that is? Are we just like living in this like existential place? Yeah. Like, I texted James in our group chat. I asked him, and he said, we're just living this like I think he called it the intelligence apocalypse. Like, where we just have access to the internet. We're all too self-aware of like what we're making and the problems that go along with it. Cause I think we talked about this a little bit on Nope. We definitely talked about it on our Babylon deep dive.
Yeah. I think
I think Men really is included with these, right?
Like, observation. Because I do think that there is an aspect, like, kind of nihilistically, I guess.
Yes.
That it's like, well, now that movies are self-aware, in order to make a movie about Barbie, and that's the only way we can fund a story about gender as a construct,
sure,
is to also let viewers know that we are in on the joke, or like we are in on the idea of this being a, I think they say like capitalism in the movie, right? Like,
yeah, she's like, I'm not a fascist. I don't control the railways or
the
commerce.
Flow of commerce. Yeah. So I think that that's like part of it too, is like signaling to your audience, hey, I get it too, especially for people who aren't watching, you know, hours of interviews like we are.
Sure.
But I also think that, you know, there's like a, maybe everyone's in, like all the filmmakers right now are kind of in their reflection era of,
sure,
of like creating movies that are referential to their previous work. That, I mean, that's really fascinating. And we've seen that as a trend,
yeah,
in recent years. I do think that Garland, like, and maybe that's why we have kind of noted or are trying to unpack this idea of why his movies in particular are so critiqued. And I think that he does have kind of like a nihilistic,
I think,
like,
so too. Yeah.
I'm playing in this, but I'm not gonna like let us come up for air.
Right.
While he does have levity, like I said, he doesn't really have humor, but that's not true. Like, he does have levity in Ex Machina specifically. I'm not sure in Annihilation. I'll have to rewatch.
Not really.
But he does also in Men, especially when you rewatch.
Mm-hmm.
And, but that doesn't mean that he like lets you off the hook at the end.
No. I mean, you could argue the end of Men feels optimistic, but you don't leave optimistic.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you're kind of hoping like maybe there will be reform one day, and like Harper will reclaim the power that was stolen from her by men. Like, and I guess like that's interesting, but this is a deeply sad movie that does have humorous beats. But I think you're right. It, going back to that word levity, Get Out, hilarious. Nope, hilarious in moments. Babylon, funny. Bo is Afraid, funny. Asteroid City, The Killer, funny. Movies, Garland's Men, like outside of Jeffrey, if you take Jeffrey out of this movie, it loses its humor, and it just, in moments where it's bizarre and you laugh, I think that's very different from intentional jokes.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think this film's tone and performances taking itself so seriously made it challenging to interpret. But I just wanted to bring up that kind of the self-interrogation of your own movie while making a movie.
Yeah.
Because I just think it's fascinating.
Yeah.
And I don't think people gave that reading to Men. But if you did, I think a lot more people would have enjoyed it in a more emotional and intellectual way than instead of just it being pissed off by the straightforward commentary or it not being scary enough.
Yeah. Well, I also think that especially since we have so many people like, which is cool, like commenting on film and mm-hmm. there's like growing audiences for, especially like A24, for example, right? Like kind of invites a lot of, especially yes. like the younger generation into watching movies, that are maybe more intellectually challenging.
Mm-hmm.
I do think though, we also have a weird, thing happening of like, I'm smarter than this movie. Like I sure. got the movie. I already understood it. And that's kind of what I was talking about before with this, I don't really love the idea of like, I need to be shocked going into a movie.
You right. know,
that doesn't need to be my experience.
And I don't need to play chess with a movie either. Yeah.
Yeah. And so anyway, so I think that is like a piece of the reading of Garland's movies. And, you know, you could totally like just also understand it and not enjoy it. And I understand for the reasons that we've talked about in terms of like how he, his pacing, his kind of prolonged dread that he creates. You know, I never feel good after I watch a Garland movie. I can understand why people probably don't want to re-experience
that.
Sad
and funny, yeah.
But I do think his movies are interesting. And specifically because I think the not letting you off the hook idea of like, I'm actually asking you to look at these men in Ex Machina. Mm-hmm. This isn't just a thriller. And I'm actually asking you to look at this concept very clearly. It's like a concept study in Men, mm-hmm. instead of having to package it, which I also enjoy from like an Eggers in a Lighthouse, or
right.
Although I don't know if that is incredibly welcoming, but package it in like a Northman, I think maybe is the better example with a Skarsgård at the center to also let people enjoy the movie and not have to even interrogate the kind of concept that they are trying to explore.
Right. So. Yes, cosign. And I also, you know, again, to people who don't like this movie and are wondering why we're covering it again, and you think it's like a pseudo pop feminist, pop psychology movie capitalizing on like gender-based issues, I understand all that. I guess we just spent this 45 minutes kind of just saying that was that's a little bit reductive, I think, of what this movie's trying to do. But I still get it.
Yeah, exactly.
Not being in on it. Okay, so you ready?
I'm so ready, yeah.
As always, our Patreon episodes are deep dives, but they are live commentaries too, so we will be watching and discussing Men. And if you are on the main feed, then you are listening to the first 30 minutes of this episode, or I guess probably the first 45. What are we closer to right now? 45?
Yeah.
45 minutes of this episode. So if you go into the description, you'll find our Patreon, the Extra Credits Plus, where you can join us on Living Plus to get access to the full 2 to 4 hour deep dives we publish on there. We have some of the best movies ever made on there from some of the best filmmakers of all time, from Goodfellas to Alien, Blade Runner, The Phantom Thread, The Social Network, Dune, lots. Portrait of a Lady on Fire, one of my favorite episodes.
Yeah.
Silence of the Lambs, another one. You'll have access to all those episodes, and you'll also receive access to our monthly newsletter with some great listener comments and episode comments in there. And you'll also be able to vote for our Patreon episodes in the future. For the month of April, I guess we can say what we have now.
Yeah.
We're doing Alfonso Cuarón's Children of Men.
In preparation for Civil War, too.
In preparation for Civil War. And then also in preparation for Civil War and in preparation for The Fall Guy, which is a movie I'm like semi-excited for just because the reviews are so crazy from people I trust who would usually hate it, who are like, it's actually great.
Yeah.
We are also covering Emily Blunt with Sicario. So that kind of fits both Garland's movie and the Fall Guy film. And at the end of the month of April, you want to say what we have?
We had our Patreon listeners vote and they have spoken. It is... Nice Guys.
The Nice Guys.
I almost got tripped up because I was thinking like Fall Guy, Free Guy, The Nice Guys.
We let There's listeners vote on like Ryan Gosling movies and they picked The Nice Guys and it won by far. And I'm really excited to revisit
too.
That movie.
Me too. I love that movie. I've always felt like it's kind of underrated, but I think there is like a community of like thinking that is a great comedy and really showcasing Gosling's talents. I think there's a lot of Ken inspiration from there. I'm excited to talk about that too. Yeah,
and neo-noirs and Russell Crowe. Lots to talk about. All right. So for any listeners who want to listen and watch along, you can stream Men free on an app called Plex, which is apparently a streaming service. And it just has a few ads. So I recommend that. You can also stream this on Showtime or you can purchase the Blu-ray like we did, because I do think that Men will become one of these Wicker Man like movies that will be very difficult to find where to purchase it. And 30-40 years. So we're gonna keep this one forever. I'm not calling it the Wicker Man, I'm just saying it could be.
Yeah,
could be a classic.
Also, there are some Wicker Man crossovers we will talk about today
for sure. All right, on play. We'll start the movie. 3, 2, 1 play. Okay, so Men, we start this movie off with the A24 symbol and then we get the off-putting
Hi.
Hello there. Sorry for interrupting.
Yeah. Thank you for listening so far. And hopefully you are enjoying the episode so far. I feel like maybe if you made it this far.
They got it this far. They're having a good time.
I mean, let's hope. But to access our full conversation, you can go to the description of this episode to join our Patreon community, the Extra Credits Plus.
Yes. And for only $5 a month, you can get access to our full catalog of Patreon exclusive episodes. Hope to see you there.